Well, good afternoon. My name is David Conway Nelson, and I would like to thank you for attending session 173, titled Transitioning with Teens. If at any time you cannot hear us, please let us know. Our panelists are going to stay at the table and use the microphones there in hope of promoting a more collegial atmosphere for discussion. Welcome to the closing evening session for Thursday. We remind you that following this session, there will be a dinner break, and then you are welcome to return for an evening devotional in the Crimson View Room. Natasha Helfer Parker's Mormon Mental Health Association will be hosting its evening conference in Salt Air. You can register for that at the door. Thank you for attending the first full day of Sunstone. We hope you've enjoyed your day so far. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones. If you hear things that are challenging to you or you disagree with, we ask that you practice what our brothers and sisters in the community of Christ call faithful disagreement. This means that you respectfully disagree while practicing empathy for the opposite point of view. At Sunstone, we recognize that there are more than one way to be a Mormon, and this means every life and experience is unique and should be honored with respect to how someone experiences their Mormonism. We invite all of you to help build a world where the richness of diversity is celebrated and empathy becomes a daily practice. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that folks can get out for dinner on time. About this presentation, transitioning away from the LDS Church comes with many complications and difficulties. Relationships between parents and teens are already complex, and transitioning introduces additional issues that must be navigated to preserve relationships. This panel is made up of parents who have transitioned from the church and with teens. They will address the issues that have presented themselves and strategies that have or have not helped the family keep its relationship intact. Cheyenne Alvarez was active and dedicated to the LDS Church for 20 years until she made a fairly sudden transition in the spring of 2016 after being alerted to historical concerns and embarking on 2 months of full-time study. Her adopted son, Javier, has chosen to remain active in the church. Mark Whitley decided to make an exit from the LDS Church in the spring of 2016 after he studied historical issues. Mark's three teenage daughters emotionally left the church for differing reasons before Mark's faith crisis. Jessica Whitley is an honor student spelling bee winner 2 years in a row, and an amazing artist and pianist. She was a very devout believing Mormon until reading the book of after reading the book Mormon multiple times. Studying evolution triggered her faith transition. Ladies and gentlemen.
All right. Thank you guys for coming. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Before I get started, can I just ask how many of you have teenagers at the moment? Okay. So a lot. So that's where I'm at as well. So as he mentioned, my name is Cheyenne Alvarez. I'm the mother of four kids ranging in ages from 12 to 18. And in March of 2016, my husband and I, after some faith turmoil and lots of study, made the decision that we would be leaving the church. And we did not make this decision lightly. It's one that we came to with much difficulty and after much prayer and study and trying to work through things. So prior to that, we had been active in the church for 20 years and did that with our children, and we're living what you might call a typical Mormon life, if there really is such a thing. So leading a high-demand religion like the LDS Church is really difficult, to say the least. I think it's more difficult when there are children involved, and in my opinion, it's even more complex if your children are in their teen years, because they likely have formed their own ideas about spiritual matters at that point that are independent of yours or somewhat linked, but also they're figuring things out for themselves, and they may or may not want to take the same path as their parents. And something that I've learned along the way is the way that I think, the way that I think things fall together logically, and the way that I follow through with things is not the way that everyone else thinks. Surprise, surprise. So living together in a group and trying to work out our different religious differences can be challenging, to say the least. And so even if your kids decide to go in the same basic direction as you, they might not kind of navigate that path in the same way either. And our transition from the church has affected each of us individually in different ways, unique ways, and it's affected our family unit as a whole. So in our case, we have mixed beliefs in our home. The current status of things is that myself, my husband, and three of my children have chosen not to be actively engaged in the church any longer. My husband has resigned his membership. Two of my children want to resign their membership. One of my children is not active but does not want to resign his membership, and is not active maybe more because we aren't rather than his own individual choice. And one of my children is active and is 17 years old and is planning on leaving for a mission as soon as possible when he turns 18 and getting married in the temple. And that's the path that he would like to take. So we are really working in our house to try to find a way to create a space where everyone can follow their own individual journeys in the way that feels good and right and fulfilling to them. Even though our journeys are not the same and at times they conflict with each other, we still want to be a strong family. Families are the bedrock in the church, and although I'm not participating in church life and belief anymore, to me, my family is still my bedrock and my most important thing, and I want to find a way to keep us strong and keep us united. So I'll give a little bit of background. I'm a convert to the church. My husband was born into the church, and he and I started dating at 15 years old when we were in high school. He was a naughty boy. He did not comply to the 16-year-old standard. Just a little side note, I actually didn't know he was Mormon when we started dating because he wasn't that into the church, and it was his best friend who told me later on that he's a Mormon, and I said, no, he's not, and he was. So that came out a little later. So I ended up talking to him. He introduced me to the missionaries, and we had planned on getting married, and we did get married right out of high school, like 3 months after he graduated, and 2 weeks before that, I was baptized into the LDS Church, much to my parents' chagrin, but that's another story for another time. So I got baptized. We became very active and engaged. I loved my new life. I loved the community in the church and the way that people rallied around me, and I was motivated to get going, and we did. So we kind of followed a traditional path after that. 4 days before I turned 21 years old, we had our first child, which was a daughter. 3 years after that, we had a son. 3 years after that, we had another son. Many, many years after that, we brought another child into our family, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. So my husband and I and our three children for the next, I guess, 18 years were active and engaged. So we held callings. We attended the temple. We served faithfully wherever we could. We raised our children to believe in the gospel as taught in the church. They were baptized when they were 8. My kids kind of had it laid out for them, priesthood at 12 for the boys, young women. We wanted them to go to BYU. That was kind of the only option, to serve missions, and to get married in the temple. And we had a plan, and we were executing it, and everything was going swimmingly. And then, in the beginning of 2016 or the end of 2015, we watched as a couple of our friends in the church decided to leave. And that was hard. And my husband was the high priest group leader, and so he was in some of the meetings, and they were talking about these folks deciding to leave. And my husband did not want to stand idly by and just let them walk away. He wanted to be Superman, and he wanted to go and rescue and bring back. And so he had a conversation with one of the friends and talked to him about what was going on with him. And long story short, this friend introduced him to some information that my husband thought didn't sound right, and he started researching so that he could explain to his friend why everything was a misunderstanding or why it was all okay anyway. And that kind of led him down a path of finding out that things weren't quite as, not just weren't quite, but were very different than what he thought they were. And we came upon some things that were disturbing, or he did. And as he sort of was having his faith kind of go tumbling, he was talking to me and asking me to look into some things. And seeing my husband, who had been a staunch, faithful, priesthood-holding man all through our marriage, even when I would stumble and have doubts, be really concerned about things, led me to be open to also looking into the same issues. And over a period of a couple months of intense study, counseling with our church leaders, reading our scriptures, praying, we decided that we needed to leave. So during this time, we didn't want to upset our children. Our kids are old enough to kind of see what's going on. They listen to discussions. We were very private about what we were going through. And we kind of felt that we would work through our faith issues and we would come out of it okay. And our kids never even had to see a struggle, that it would all be figured out and God would step in and he would soothe us and provide answers and we would get over that bump in the road. So when we decided to leave, we were kind of at a point like, we can't do this. We made the decision, and my kids were not aware of any problems before that. And I'm not making a recommendation that people approach things that way, but that's how we did it. And so we went in one Sunday, and we attended the meeting that day, and afterward we met with the bishop, and we told him that we were leaving and we needed to resign from our callings and we wouldn't be attending anymore. And then we went home and we called a family meeting and we announced to our kids that we would be leaving, and they were in absolute shock. So kind of where they were at the time of our announcement, my daughter was 17 years old. She was a junior in high school. She probably a year before had a real like faith awakening at EFY. She was really dedicated to the church. She was planning on serving a mission. She was planning on going to BYU, finding a mate, marrying in the temple. That was hard for her to hear, and her initial reaction wasn't good. My son was 14. He was not emotionally invested in the church. He did not like attending. He didn't like going to the activities. And we always kind of thought, he'll find his testimony later. And so when we made that announcement, he was like, what? Whoa. And yes, like he was happy about it. And we were like, oh my gosh, he's going to think he was always right. And his parents really don't know everything, but that's the way it stood. My youngest son was 11. He was finishing up fifth grade. He was on the cusp of receiving the priesthood. He really believed in what he had been taught and loved the church community. He had been raised in the same ward his whole life, and so that was his family, his next family. So during this kind of announcement and meeting, we explained to the kids that that was our decision, and we kind of talked to them about a few of our major issues, and we let them know that they did not have to take the same route that we did, and that there were a lot of really, really smart people in the church who knew all the same things that we knew and who didn't find them to be impediments to their faith, and that that was an option for them, and that they could make their own decisions. And whatever they decided, we would support them along the way. And if they wanted to go on missions, we would support them. And if they wanted to get married in the temple, we would stand outside and we would wait for them and we would be happy for them. So they ended up making decisions. My daughter was really upset. She initially didn't even, she tried to walk away and she was crying. And so we presented her with some information and encouraged her to do her own study. And after doing that for herself and meeting with church leaders to ask questions and work through her own issues, she decided that she was going to leave along with us. But she was heartbroken over it, as were we. My 14-year-old, he was good. He was like, this is great. This is what I always wanted. My 11-year-old decided to leave, but he was really upset. So his initial reaction, he's not a teen, but he's right there. And so I'm going to just talk a little bit about him, too. He didn't want his friends and his teachers at church to think that he was a bad kid. And he didn't want to feel like a bad kid. And I don't know that he was really fully able to process kind of what was happening in the way that our older kids were. So things were complicated. Things were hard. We were working through things. That was in March of last year. Then in September, things got a lot more complicated. Back up to August, my husband and I received a phone call that we had been waiting for 2 years almost. And that was that the adoption of a boy from Ecuador that we knew previously, a teen, was the paperwork had finally finished up and that we could travel and go and complete the adoption. So that was happening in the middle of this. And one of the first questions actually that we asked ourselves when we had our faith crisis was, what about this adoption? Because we felt that God had led us to do it. And we decided that no, that we felt that this was just the right thing to do. So how that kind of came about was our now son, I first met him in Ecuador at an orphanage when he was 12 years old. I went down on a service trip with a friend with a charity that someone she knew had started. And he was living at an orphanage that was for boys, for older boys, that they like to keep separated from the younger kids. And he was just a cute kid. I had no plans for adoption. Been more than happy with the kids I have and felt like that was enough for me. So we took our whole family down in 2014 to Ecuador again, and we went and served various places, but we went to another orphanage that he was now living at, and we really formed a connection with him. And on that trip, we talked about feeling led like we needed to do more than show up and provide material support for a week and do what we were doing. And so we decided that we wanted to try to adopt this boy. And at the time that we knew him, he was a Christian. He was attending a Pentecostal church, so we knew he believed in God, and that's where he was at. So when we started the adoption process, we were not allowed to have contact with him in the meantime because we weren't supposed to influence anything. They had to try to contact his next of kin and all that. And so while we were leaving the church, our son actually decided to join the church down in Ecuador, independent from us. So that added another layer of complication. And he was a dedicated member down there. He attended church weekly, and he had very little money, and he took the money that he had, and he bought himself bus fare to go to seminary in the mornings. And so he was dedicated. So my husband and I knew that we had to travel down to Ecuador, and we had to tell this boy that who knew that we were LDS, who wasn't supposed to know that we were adopting him, but because of clues along the way, we figured he probably knew that it was us. We had to tell him that, you know, you knew us in 2014, and this was the situation then, and we now know that you have joined the church, but we have left it in the interim. And we wanted to tell him that before anything was final so that he could back out if he wanted to. The eternal family bit and all that. So so we told him, and he decided that he still wanted to be adopted, but I think that it was a shock to him as well. I'm sure that it was a shock to him as well. So again, we had the conversation, we'll support you in whatever your choices are, you can follow your own path, we'll be there for you regardless. So we completed the adoption, and we came home. And right now, he has decided that he wants to remain active in the church. He wants to serve a mission. He wants to go to the temple. He does not want to know the reasons why we left. He doesn't want to talk about it. We go to church with him. We sit next to him. He knows that we have some issues with things in the history. He doesn't know the details, except very recent development. He asked me some questions, and I don't know if that, I'm enjoying that, because I think that we need to talk more openly, and that's my hope. But for the moment, he is mostly just doesn't really care to know. And we, as much as we want to talk to him and tell him, we have decided that we're not going to force anything on him, and that's his decision to make. And that's kind of what we have had to do to help the relationship develop in a healthy way. So even though I don't believe in the truthfulness of the church, I actually think that right now, for him and for his individual circumstances, and maybe for other kids not in his circumstances, that it's a good place for him. The church is a place where he feels part of a community, and he feels loved and encircled about and supported. And I think that for some people, maybe that trumps what I think constitutes truth, which has been a realization that I think I've had to come to over time. Of course, it's really difficult for us. One really painful thing for us that was even more stressful than I thought it would be was that our son, who was ordained a priest in Ecuador, they didn't keep good records, or something happened where the records were lost, needed to be reordained here. And so we needed to attend his ordination and sit on the sidelines, and I had to sit next to my husband and watch someone else put their hands on our son's head, who we're trying to bond with and become a tight family with, and have that connection with him and ordain him as a priest. And that was especially painful, feeling like he probably thought that, you know, his father was unworthy. Everyone around thought that we were unworthy. That wasn't the main concern, but it was just a weird feeling that we had never been on that side of things. And it was more of a difficult emotional experience than we even thought that it would be. So that's been tough, but we feel like we need to do it for him. So through this process, and through helping all our kids kind of go through their own things and figure out how to get along, we've had to work on a lot of things in order to keep misunderstandings and conflicts and emotions in check. So we've had to really up our communication skills. We have to talk a lot now about how are you feeling? How are you interpreting this? What do you think about this? What do you, this is the way I feel about this. What about you? Even my son, who's active in the church, who it's more difficult to talk to about the faith things, we have to check in with him, let him know that we feel a certain way, but consistently reassure him that his feelings are valid. We've had to work really hard to see things from more than one angle. I kind of assumed that the way I saw things was going to be the way that other people would see things, and that has proven to be so not true. And so even my kids who have decided to leave have just really had different difficulties as they've transitioned out, or different concerns than I might expect or anticipate. And I would love to talk about that a little bit more later, and maybe through some discussion. You know, trying to make sure that our emotional needs are met and the emotional needs of our kids has been are met is a challenge, because there's not one prescribed way now. I kind of feel like we had a formula and a way of doing things in the church, and now everything's kind of up, and we have to figure out how to deal with everyone's stuff with methods that are new, and figure out new methods. And sometimes we've done a really good job of this, and things have floated along pretty smoothly. And sometimes we have not, and things have just exploded and bubbled over, and we've had arguments, and we've had emotional breakdowns, and everyone's cried and yelled, and we have felt like, did we screw this up so bad that we can't fix it? Have we broken ourselves and broken our children and broken our family? But you know what? We haven't. Those moments, I think, are part of making a huge paradigm shift in our lives. And what I've seen in my own family over time is that things feel so unsteady and unsure in the beginning, and then they feel a little better for us. And when there's been times when I thought everything's under control, we've got it, we're figuring this out, and then everything falls apart again. No, we don't, back up, let's reevaluate, and then things come together again. And now I feel like we're in a place where the transition overall has been a really good thing for all of us. Not to say that there are not continued difficulties and issues, not to say that we don't all have our own things and emotions that we're still working through, and not to say that my teens are all great. We've done some counseling with individuals, which we had never tried before, but I feel like for the most part our avenues of communication have really opened up. I can talk to my kids now about things that were not going to be an open discussion before. I can talk to my kids, and they come to me and ask me things sometimes that I think, oh my gosh, like, do you talk about this with your mom? You know, but we do now, and it's a wonderful feeling to be able to be open and honest and to hear my kids' opinions about anything from drugs and alcohol and sex and friendships and marriage and any question that they have that before we would not have broached together because it was taboo or did not fit within the guidelines, or certain opinions were not acceptable. And so that has been kind of a brilliant development in our family, and one that I think that all my kids agree on is a good thing. Oh my goodness, I'm talking for so long. So I am going to leave it there. I'm hoping that we can get into some discussion. I have more comments and thoughts straight from my teen kids. And we have Jessica here also as our kind of teen representative. And we would like to really hopefully hear from some of you who have teenagers and talk through some of this. But Mark, if you want to just kind of go ahead and...
Sure. Everybody hear me okay? Great. Hi, my name is Mark. Thanks, love. I was born in the covenant, hit all the major Mormon milestones, baptized at age 8, read the Book of Mormon at age 16, and got that spiritual witness. Served a mission at age 19, Miami, Florida, Spanish. Married in the temple. My parents were and are very devout believers. I've served in numerous church callings, including elders, quorum president, executive secretary, and even a first counselor in the bishopric. And I think it's obligatory to add, and I even come from pioneer stock. So there's that box checked on my Mormon cred scale. We have three daughters who we raised in the church. My eldest daughter was born with a very questioning, skeptical mind. Even at a young age, she always had numerous questions. For example, about Bible stories that seem strange and illogical. How can you really spend 3 days inside a whale, kind of thing. At around age 17, she concluded she didn't believe in Mormonism anymore. She says it wasn't one thing that caused her to disbelieve, but the accumulation of numerous small things that added up. Some highlights include she read the Book of Mormon, and she tried the Moroni's Promise, and she got nothing. No warm, fuzzy feelings. Nothing even remotely fuzzy. So, it didn't help. She had a feminist awakening and began to dislike the culture of sexism and misogyny that she perceived in the church. And she was very displeased with the way the church treated certain groups of people, like LGBT people, some of whom were her friends. She eventually concluded that the suffering she experienced inside church was greater than anything she would experience outside. She was the first member of our family to leave the church, a modern-day pioneer. And she says she no longer thinks much about Mormonism at all, for which I'm a little envious. I'll let my middle daughter tell her own story in a minute here. My youngest daughter never believed, but she attended with family anyway. She always hated church and was bored to death with it. Towards the end of my active believing membership, I would sometimes see her just hanging her head as she shuffled off to primary. On some occasions, I took pity on her and said, you look tired. Do you want to just go home and rest now that sacrament meeting's done? And she would always reply with a relieved and exuberant yes and run home. So, tender mercies. I had a faith crisis in March of 2016. There were numerous events that led up to my shelf break, experiencing depression, serving in a bishopric and seeing the uninspired and ethically questionable leadership of the bishop and stake president, witnessing the November 5th policy and the resulting spike in suicides afterwards, learning the uncorrelated version of church history, that was a head trip, and learning about confirmation bias, or the spiritual witness. When I'll just add this as a little aside, during the time that I was navigating through my faith crisis, I reached out to various friends of mine to kind of let them know what was going on with me and to find support. I started small, my wife, my family, things like that. And then eventually I branched out to friends of mine who I knew had left the church and who I thought could be sympathetic, help orient me a little bit, to some of my Nevermo friends. And then eventually I got into where I was willing to talk to believing friends. One of the believing friends that I reached out to is a former mission buddy of mine who now lives in Texas, and I discovered is a bishop of his ward. And, I was polite, respectful, didn't go into too much detail, but I just said, I studied it, I thought it through, I just don't believe anymore. And he replied, yeah, it's fine, I respect your decision, it's cool, but man, I just don't understand this. I just had a high priest group leader tell me the same thing. Well, guess who that guy was?
That was my husband.
Husband of this lady sitting to my left. So, small world. Smaller church. Yeah. When I told my daughters I didn't believe in Mormonism anymore, the first thing they asked with bated breath was, does this mean we don't have to go to church anymore? They were delighted to hear an affirmative response from me. I also had to admit to my eldest daughter, who was the first to leave, I'm sorry for making you go to church all those years. You were right all along. I was just doing what I thought was best. I'm sorry, honey. That was a humbling moment for me. My wife was the last to leave. She never had a Moroni's Promise conversion experience, but she liked the community the church provided. Things were initially tense between us when I was going through my faith crisis. There was not always mutual respect. I may have said some things that were perhaps regrettable. Maybe she did too. But this was the first time I'd gone through a faith crisis before, so I didn't have much of a playbook to go off of or any experience to draw from. But I'm pleased to report that after numerous lengthy discussions, we got to where we see eye to eye. We're communicating very openly and honestly now, and our marriage is not only intact, but stronger for the trial. She told me once that she got to a point where she said, well, I either need to pick the church or my husband. She picked her husband. We've been out for over a year now, and we find new activities to do, especially on Sundays. We like going on hikes, having Sunday brunch with people. We like doing gardening together, get-togethers with cousins and in-laws. We like watching movies and shows together. Stranger Things, check it out. We play board games and the like. I have attended and still attend a religious transition group that meets at the South Valley Unitarian Universalist Society. My wife has joined me a couple of times for that. I've also attended some ex-Mormon meetup groups, for example, one that meets at a coffee shop called Cafenio in downtown Salt Lake. One of the best changes that we've observed is that we can now communicate openly and authentically with our kids. We don't have to limit our discussion to church-approved topics, and we don't have to run all of our thinking through the filter of Mormonism anymore. So, that's me. Time for Jess to tell her story.
Hello, can you hear me? I'm Jessica Whitley. Did you say? Do it like this?
No, you're good. Yeah, keep going.
I'm Mark's middle daughter. I was born in the church to LDS parents. Growing up, I attended church with my parents and two sisters every week. When I was around 11 years old, I became actively religious, trying to understand and follow the gospel individually. I was exactingly Mormon throughout junior high, which I attended at a very small, close-knit school where very few students were not Mormon. And at the end of ninth grade, the idea of evolution started bothering me as it hadn't done previously. This threat to my life's foundation scared and possessed me for months. I researched the church's position on creation and evolution online and wandered into unfamiliar philosophical territory. Over several months, I discussed my concerns with my parents and other family members and my young women leaders who had become close friends. Despite being contrary to everything I believed, I read more and more into atheist and agnostic viewpoints and gradually found that, impossibly, the reasoning of Korihor's was not as deadly as I thought. As I began at a new school with new people and discussions, I began to seriously consider a non-Mormon reality for the first time. At length, I came to the conclusion that I could not remain in a position that defined reason. The church's position could not allow me to accept both the Old Testament and dinosaurs. And I didn't want to believe in a world without dinosaurs. I only took one semester of seminary that year. The next semester it was replaced by Apostasy 101. Later, I worried that I left the church too hastily or for a reason that was erroneously black and white. But I have continually learned about the expansive philosophical and historical conflicts with the church, thanks to my dad's faith crisis. I am assured that leaving the church was an advantageous choice for many reasons, including but not limited to rewritten Mormon history, racism, oppression of women and the LGBT community, lack of archaeological evidence for the Book of Mormon, and Studio C's inferiority to SNL as a sketch comedy. I had never imagined that I would leave the church. The transition was excruciating, but both Mormon and non-Mormon family members helped me through it. I didn't feel that I needed to come out to my family members or Ward once I stopped believing in God and the gospel. I hated the idea of causing my parents the same violent religious dissonance that I had felt. However, they found out around the time it happened based on my online research. Neither of my sisters believed at that point, so I was better able to connect with them. I am very lucky that my family gets along so well that I can take it for granted and that there was no contention between us when I stopped believing. We continued to do Mormon activities as a family, which I had no issue with. In fact, I encouraged them. I liked the family togetherness that family prayer and scripture study afforded, and I still miss family home evening a little. Church was fine as an atheist. I had grown up in the ward, so I enjoyed seeing my friends and neighbors. My non-believing sister and I had an atheist friend in Young Women. I enjoyed thinking about morality and theology in church, playing the piano, singing in the ward choir with my dad, girls' camp, and having church as a dependable weekly family activity. Throughout the next year, my family only became more important to me, as I viewed life as temporary with no promise of eternity. Things continued normally for my family, as church had always been a part of our lives. In 2016, I was shocked and worried when my dad had a faith crisis and left the church. I feared that our family's relationships could be disrupted now that a parent stopped believing. Thankfully, it never became more than a worry, and my family is still close and connected. Religion is a big part of life, but so is family. Since I stopped believing, my family has morphed its Mormonism. We no longer pray or go to church. Although it's now in the past, I experienced Mormonism not only as a religion and potent force in my identity, but also as memories which my family experienced together. Wards may reject church members who leave, but a family has this shared history and strength to love its members in all stages of transition.
We have about 48 minutes left. Would any of the panelists, do you have anything else you want to add before we open the floor to questions?
So I asked my kids recently, my kids that have left, because it's still a little dicey with my son who has not left, with the open conversation about faith and us leaving, but I asked them what they felt were positives and negatives about our transition out of the church, and I just wanted to share a couple of those things. And if you guys have teenagers, I would love to hear from you about kind of where you're at, if you've transitioned out of the church, if you're thinking about it, if this is just something that's fun to watch. So my daughter, who's now 18, said positive things for her are new experiences with things that were off limits, like coffee, tea, and she wants to try alcohol in the future. I still have some fears about that. She thinks that it's been a great relief feeling guilt for every little infraction, and something that she experienced more so when we first left, but I think still a little bit, is that even though her logical mind tells her one thing about, okay, I don't really believe that this is truth or that this is the law from God, she still feels guilt over things like wearing a sleeveless shirt. Like, she knows that there's nothing wrong with it in her head, but in her heart, she feels like maybe I'm a bad person. Like, she has some conflict there, and so I feel like that's a part of the ingraining of the faith that we had. And she feels like it really brought us closer as a family. Negatives for her were losing friends. She watched all her friends go off to college and go on missions. So that's been hard. She felt lost on a spiritual level, still to some point, and having to plan a new future since, oh my goodness, now I'm not going to BYU for sure. I'm not going on a mission. What do I do? My son, who is now 15, thought there was only positives. He doesn't have to go to activities he doesn't want to go to, and he doesn't have to be the one that can't participate on Sundays. And my son, who's 12, said the positives are more free time, the negatives are losing friends and awkwardness with people at church. And he, I think, still feels like maybe we made a big mistake on some level and lost our community. So that was their feeling. And I'd love to hear about what your teenagers are going through.
You're free to stand up and speak out, or if you are more comfortable, use the microphone over there.
Is my voice loud enough to hear?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to say positive things. I'm really glad I came to this one. I love both of all three of your stories. This is my own wacky cosmology, and I'll keep it short, but I think that Shakespeare, when he died, he went to the spirit world, he kicked out those Greek fates that used to decide what people's lives are like, and he wrote a little play for everybody in life, and you've got a play where you left the church while that kid who you love was joining. Oh my gosh, that's like totally Shakespearean.
It is. You can. Maybe outside.
Mark, I love your shirt. I consider buying a paper. My dad wears such shirts with holes on them, but that was my path, the real intellectual.
So are you transitioned out, or you're still in the church?
I just go to sacrament.
Okay, so your wife and kids are believing. Okay.
No.
So you didn't know. Like, what was the first big surprise? Did he just cap copy it?
No, he told us.
So he came out and told us.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind if I just speak to that real quick with respect to, you know, being closeted, keeping it in?
If this thing were recorded, so speaking in the mic would be a good idea.
Yeah, no, you're right. I'm going to use this terminology. I entered Fowler's stage four, like 4 years before I had a faith crisis. And it just sort of gradually accumulated. Just to elaborate on that a little bit, since we seem to have an abundance of time. I've heard it said that, and just to bring it, does anyone not know about Fowler stages, Fowler stage four? Basically, stage three is when you're in the box, you're a TPM, right? Stage four is when you're out of the box. You say, I hate that box is dumb, kind of thing. So no one ever willingly enters stage four. This is not a place people want to go. It's a place full of angst and anger and depression and frustration and, you know, saying goodbye to community and rebuilding things from the ground up. I would compare it to, like, say, going through puberty. You're like, there's these strange changes coming over me. I don't understand them. I don't know where this is all going. This has never happened to me before. I'm scared. But I can't help it. This train's left the station. So, Yeah, a lot of that manifested with, you know, just sort of gradually distancing myself from church and opening myself up to alternate viewpoints and just weight accumulating on my shelf until it broke kind of thing. And, yeah, so...
Yeah, go to Elder's Quorum until it's unbearable, and then you stop going to that.
Yeah, yeah, and the craziest thing was, is it used to be fulfilling for me.
Yeah.
You know, it was good for me until it wasn't. You know, it's the funniest thing.
And Jessica, you couldn't tell until you mentioned it.
So I can sort of speak to that. And why?
Excuse me.
My daughter, who's,
could I hold on one second? Sure. You've been waiting in line for a long time.
Well, I just was going to say. So when I approached my daughter, who was off to college, and said, "I need you to know this. I've told my bishopric I'm done," and you know. She says, "Dad, you've been unhappy for a long time. I'm glad that you finally are acknowledging it and telling me." Yeah. They love you. They care about you. And she'd seen the full version of activity in me, but she also knew there was something off and couldn't wait for Dad to get back to the happy version of himself. And so...
I just wanted to add one more thing, and then we'll get right to you. Sorry about this, sir. With respect to weighing the decision of whether to come out or not, I had been experiencing clinical depression for like 8 years leading up to my shelf break. And for the most part, I bottled it up. I kept it inside. And you know why I did? Because, you know, in the Book of Mormon, Nephi, who's supposed to be this great guy, he never complained, right? His brother's tied to a mast. They beat him with sticks. He doesn't complain. So I'm like, I want to be like that guy. Well, it turns out Nephi's a fictional character, and that's a fictional narrative. So, and it also turns out that I'm not as strong as I thought. So, I learned the hard way. It is important to talk about your problems. You don't have to put on this macho front. It's, you know, you can be vulnerable. You can be broken. It's okay. When I first started learning the uncorrelated version of church history, and I was like, oh my gosh, Mormon Think and Mormon Expression podcast and Mormon Stories and just consuming all this stuff. There was one Mormon Stories episode I read about, I'm going to get his name wrong, Clay Christensen, is that right? Nodding heads? Yes, okay. And he basically said that he remained silent for 13 years and just couldn't come out because he didn't want to make waves. He didn't want to rock the boat. And it just ate him up inside. And finally he came out, and like a relative of his said, oh my gosh, you too? And they, you know, made this connection. And so I said to myself, okay, no, I'm not doing that. I'm going to learn from history rather than repeat it. And, you know, I think it might have been. Yeah, and I had bottled it all up during the time I was battling with depression, so I said, I'm not going to bottle this up any longer. So came out to my wife first, we hashed it out, came out to my daughter shortly after. Very glad I did. Very glad.
So, as to whether or not I could tell if he was leaving the church having a faith crisis, he mentioned that he had been experiencing depression, and we knew that as children, as his children. So we knew that there was something rotten in the state of Denmark, but I was pretty clueless.
Cheyenne, Mark, and Jessica, thanks for sharing with us, especially your level of candor. Cheyenne, particularly, you had a great deal of detail there. And thank you, too, for being fair-minded as you went through each step. I didn't sense at any level that you were coming to a place of reckless abandonment. You were discovering things, you were reviewing them, you're preserving things of greatest value to you, your family, and the integrity of that. As a quick bio sketch, I'm in the same place you are, but also very different, and I'm weighing that difference. To speak quickly about it, Mark I'm clawing myself out of Fowler stage four right now, while remaining active LDS. I've found a new hope in my elders' quorum and the lessons, and sort of growing there in a way that perhaps wouldn't be the most pleasing to the bishop, but I have a good collection of elders around me with sufficient numbers of us who are progressive while respectful to the traditional way. Enough on that for now. Another way that my life has been different than yours is my father is a university professor of history, American history, world history, Mormon history, and knows that history from every angle is complex, and Mormonism is just a subset of that. Now to get to my question, as I look around me in the larger community, the Mormons that I see that crash the hardest, that leave Mormonism in the most painful way, were the most entrenched Mormons, the most active Mormons, the most rigorous and focused Mormons while they were active, in contrast with those other Mormons that were kind of more fluid. They followed rules and policies for the most part, but they never saw them as absolutes. They realized that there were exceptions here and there, and some of them maybe abused those margins, most did not. And I'm wondering if you see patterns too in the Mormons around you that learn about unsettling details of Mormon history, where in my home I have prominent childhood memories of my father working in complex Mormon topics into family home evening. He would do it age specific, and I don't mean to imply that I always cared about what he was teaching. I mean, I was cared about, you know, grades and girls and acne and all those kinds of things that beset a seventh grader, eighth grader, ninth grader. But later on, things that he had said became more meaningful later on in my life. So back to the question, do you see this around you too, that the Mormons that are the most pained by new discovery were the most entrenched earlier?
I think I see some of that. Our couple friends in the ward, they left under, one was for historical reasons. Actually, one was the one that even presented the history to my husband, or the beginnings of some of the historical discrepancies to my husband. We found out left mentally about 6 years ago for unrelated reasons, but the historical stuff just, he felt like, backed up his belief and would be more of a, like a, see, here's something solid to look at. So him and another one of our friends who left the church also for different reasons, but I feel like I see that pattern that you described in myself and in some people online. I'm intense. I was really trying to follow everything as much as possible, although I started to give myself some breaks at some point. But I also feel like I was attracted to the church, partly for the, like, laying it out black and white. I'm a rule follower. I'm kind of an intense, like, this, I like this, and for this reason it was laid out this way, and this is the story, and why it made sense, and if this is no longer the story, it no longer makes sense to me. And so I don't know if that's really answers your question in the way that you were looking for, but I feel like the people who crash and burn the hardest and have the most traumatic experiences coming out of the church are people who were intense and dedicated. And I feel like part of that is because, like, for me, I sacrificed relationships with my family along the way that felt that I joined a cult and I fought so hard against it and stood up, and I sacrificed so much, I felt like. And so for me to find out that what I thought was truth to me is not truth, God damn it. I, you know, that was, it was too much. That crashed me down hard. And I think that's probably similar for a lot of people.
Yeah, just to give my answer, I think the pattern you described is emphatically true. I think the people that are the most devout experience the most pain when they have a faith crisis. That was certainly the case with me, and it's been the case with other friends of mine that I've talked to. I think I have some very fastidious tendencies, just as part of my personality. There's a condition known as scrupulosity, where you want to just follow everything rigidly by the book, color inside the lines all the time, the whole thing. And I think I possess some of those traits. And the church just really brought all that out, you know, and just provided this wonderful playground where I could just be as scrupulous as I could be. And, like when I was Elders Quorum president, it was just diligent, doing PPIs every month with everybody, doing midweek visits every Wednesday, just boom, 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 hitting all the targets. To then discover, that what I believed in, just to have it all flake away underneath my feet and to just feel like I was just falling into this void, it was terrifying. It's the worst roller coaster I've ever been on. I sometimes think that the people that are maybe a little more half-hearted, a little more casual about their church membership, those guys are actually in better shape. You know, they've got a little bit better mental health going into this whole thing. King Benjamin said, "A man need not run faster than he had strength." It would be great if the LDS Church actually followed that advice. I think it would lead to, much better mental health overall in the membership. So, with respect to, coming out of that void, one person that I reached out to, another mission buddy of mine, he actually had a shelf crash, went through Fowler stage 4, and he's now in stage 5. He has reassured me that the healing that you experience eventually will be commensurate with the pain that you felt going down the rabbit hole. And I'm trying to have faith that that will be the case. So, someday.
I'd say I had a similar experience to my dad's, because half of me is him. But I remember once when I was a true believing Mormon, he said he was concerned about how intense I was about it, and he said, "I'm worried that you're going to be like a rubber band, and if you stretch yourself too far, like you're stretching yourself, you're going to break." And I thought, that's never ever going to happen, but it did. So you never know.
I apologize if my little mini outburst was offensive. It just occurred to me. We have a spectrum of people here, and I never would have used that phrase before, so I'm feeling a little guilt.
You're okay. You're within the box.
Okay.
I just wanted to add, in case any parents have ever wondered, do your children ever listen to you? She listens.
Yeah.
So.
Question for Jessica. I'm really curious about your experience with your friends and go in and out of the church and that transition and how that impacted your relationships with them.
Well, I mentioned that I was friends with my young women leaders. I never told them that I left the church. And since we moved out of the ward, I don't see them. But my family,
I do have a friend that's my age who has also left the church. I don't know if he has told his parents, but I've talked to him once, and he said that despite the hateful aspects of the church, he was glad to have been raised in it for the positive values that it does teach. You know, being Christ-like, service, being compassionate, those kind of things. So,
I have a question. I kind of want to hear from you guys, but I want to hear more from the parents on it. I have buddies that are just scared out of their mind about the core values that their children now wouldn't have. The morals.
Not have.
Yeah, where are they going to get their morality? So speak to where you get your foundational beliefs. Not even beliefs, but how you go about, because I know you do. You can be a balanced, wonderful human being without meetings and institutions telling you how to do that. So how is it that you find confidence in your behavior, your choices, your moral compass? And then what kinds of things are you guys doing to ensure your children are confident, are finding their way? I've got a lot of friends that they just get out of their minds because they've left, and now they're like,
My kids are gonna
end up on the streets with needles in their arms, which is, it's kind of the extremes of Mormonism. That's what we were told the outside world would look like. So, you're obviously doing great. Had brunch with them recently, but so speak to how you're finding your core values and moral compass, and what keeps you a good, positive individual in the world. Outside of the institutions of religion.
Okay, so that's a difficult question because I think that's what people have been trying to answer for all of human history. But I'd say that I guess the basis of my morality is to understand and respect people. And that's about it. Well,
that makes sense to me.
If I were Mormon or something like yeah. it, I could recite something.
Well, but that was one of the responses I had to one of my friends. What core values? To love others, respect others. You don't need the church to tell you that, and that's what you just said. So I think you're. But I also respect that you're still. We're all still trying to figure it out.
Would you mind if I answered a question from him on that? I left the LDS Church 18 years ago, and I started over. I married a wonderful lady who's sitting in the back of the room, and she'd never heard of Mormons before, or if she would, it was only a history lesson. She raised her kids with a lot of really good values and never darkened the door of an LDS church. My family currently goes to United Church of Christ. Our minister performs gay marriages. We're into a lot of public service. We run soup kitchens and food distribution for poor people. We're the kind of church that if you rolled a grenade down the aisle one Sunday, you'd kill half the Democrats in town. And quite frankly, I'm pretty happy with the 15-year-old that Ruth and I have. She's got pretty good moral compass. And, you know, she looks at TV and sees some of the things that the politicians say. And she's the one that believes that they don't have a good moral value. So, you know, I don't know why people that were Mormon or people that are strict in other faiths believe that if you leave that faith, you're also leaving your moral compass, your values. I just don't think it's necessary to have religious beliefs in order to have to do what's right.
Can I go real quick and then? So, to answer your question about where do we get our morality from, this is something I've pondered on a lot, and in the kind of stage four deconstructionist frame of mind that I'm in now, I'm looking for naturalistic, rational explanations, particularly ones that don't require any cognitive distance, big plus. So I researched evolution as well, and one thing that I discovered in my studies is that humans are a rather remarkable species in that we have evolved to be a cooperative species. We're not like solitary predators, like, you know, say rattlesnakes, that just they don't cooperate at all with any of their species. No, we get along, and you know, so there, this has helped us to make huge societies and build buildings together. We sent a man to the moon. I mean, it's amazing stuff that we can accomplish. But what I discovered also is that morality is a byproduct of our having evolved to be a cooperative species. So, you know, if I'm trying to cooperate with the members of my tribe, I shouldn't kill them, because then they won't be able to work with me to build this hut. And, you know, I maybe shouldn't sleep with the tribal chief's daughter because he'll get mad at me, and we won't be able to cooperate as well. It'll cause friction. So, you know, and I probably shouldn't steal his tools, because then, you know, he won't be able to help me build this bridge or whatever. And you know, in addition to those don'ts, there's also a lot of do's that we've evolved. Oh, there's someone that's hurt. I should help them out. These parents died and left these children without a home. I should take them in mind so that they're not this orphan. You know, and this is an amazing thing that we have, and it's all inside us. And I'm just going to add this in there. Siddhartha Gautama, aka the Buddha, he was raised as a Hindu, and he saw that there was just this massive pantheon of gods, and layer upon layer of gods that you had to go through to get to the Dharma. And he had this revolutionary thought where he said, we don't need to go through these layers and layers of gods to get the Dharma. It's all inside of you. All you have to do is look inward, and you can find it. So I think, frankly, one of the biggest cons that religions have pulled over the years is to teach us that we're all broken and horrible inside, and we need them to tell us what's right and wrong. The exact opposite is true. Humans didn't get their morality from religions. Religions got their morality from humans, and then they packaged it up and sold it back to us. The opposite of that scripture is... Yeah, let me just kind of add a postscript and put it this way. Our perception of God is an idealized form of human morality.
Right.
What does that say? Well, the old primary song, I am a child of God, that still resonates with me. You know, I like the
whatever
label...
that all means.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about labels these days, but one I can live with is humanist, because it says that there is a spark of the divine inside of it.
Can you consider?
Yeah, you've been waiting a long time.
Yep,
please.
Make it official. So I just wanted to speak to the morality question, but also back to something, is it Jessica? I don't want to get your name wrong. Something you said about how, was it your friend or someone who said that they were still glad they were raised in the church because it taught them good things. So for me, I was raised in the church, and I raised my kids in the church, and My transition happened really rapidly. I went from, I know the church is true, to I'm an atheist in about a month. So it was, once I started questioning things, it just snowballed really quickly. And back to, like, the subject of how to tell your kids, I at first was scared to just come out, like, I've been telling them this one thing their whole life, and then to say, oh, just kidding, like, I was totally wrong about that. I didn't want to shock them, and I didn't know how to approach it, and so I tried at first to be really subtle, and I was actually at BYU at the time, finishing my degree, and so I didn't want to risk my status there and my endorsement, and so I thought, we'll just keep going to church, and I'll just maybe start bringing up questions, you know, like, oh, maybe the prophet could be wrong sometimes, you know. I don't know, just like tried to be subtle about it and stuff. And I thought, you know, the church was still, it's still a good place to raise my kids, and it's still going to teach them good things, and I want to have that moral framework. And so for, you know, about a month, I kept trying to just go and trying to just introduce nuance. I thought over the next year while I finish my degree, I could just introduce a little nuance and we could slowly see where this goes and still just raise them in the church the rest of the way and it'll probably be fine. And then I had an experience where I was fully, like, mentally out of the church, and one of my callings was to play the piano at stake baptisms, and we always played the same songs, and so we played the song If the Savior Stood Beside Me, and I had a panic attack at the piano because I was reading the words for the first time from a different perspective and realized that it had been really, really unhealthy for me to internalize all of that fear and guilt and shame over, like, there's these unseen beings, like, watching you 24/7, reading your thoughts and keeping notes, and they're going to shout from the rooftops everything you do in your life. And that kind of trying to scare you into being good, on top of telling you, you know, the 270,000 commandments of Mormonism, that you have to follow or you're going to be judged harshly. Like, I now, like, in that moment, as I realized this wasn't good for me, like, it still was good in some ways. I'm not saying it's totally bad, but I realized it hadn't been healthy for me. It hadn't been a good way to set up a moral framework to just try and scare you into being good. And so now, like, we actually, all of my kids are out of the church now, and pretty much for the most part, except girls camp is the only draw right now. So we're navigating that. But my atheist girls didn't really like girls camp this last year. So I don't know how long that will last, but they want that community. They want their friends, but they don't know what to do with it all now. So we're trying to rebuild. But like you said, it was, I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm trying to build up a new moral framework based on the rational considerations of actual consequences of my actions, and, like, you know, is having a thought about somebody when I see them in, you know, sexy clothing going to hurt anybody? Probably not. So maybe I could quit feeling guilty about that one. Like, just kind of going through everything and saying, actually, all of these things I don't think are bad. And what things, I like what Sam Harris says about the well-being of conscious creatures being the baseline of what is moral and what's immoral. Like, anything that promotes wellness and, you know, well-being is a good thing. And anything that takes away from the well-being of conscious creatures is a bad thing. And that's, like, just kind of evaluating, are my actions harmful? Are they not harmful? And building up from there and just being able to have those conversations with my kids. I didn't mean for this to be so long, sorry. I had to lay some groundwork. No, but yeah, like, I feel like it's better. I feel like it's a better way. And I feel like we're not getting our morals, like the church isn't getting its morals from the scriptures, you know. It's evolved past them, because I think the things that resonate with us from the scriptures, like love your neighbor as yourself, it resonates with us because there's something inside of us that says we should be doing those things. And the parts that don't resonate with us, we don't really read over the pulpit anymore. So we're kind of building our own moral framework anyway, even within the church. So I don't know. That's my long answer.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I've got three sons that are all thriving in the church. Mark, they're kind of what you described. They're very scrupulously obedient. They love it. I'm an active non-believer, biding my time. And I'm to that point where my wife knows where I'm at. She's fearful every time I open my mouth. And she's just saying, don't, you know, it's working. The kids are doing great. Just let it take its course. What would your advice be? What approach would you take with kids that really, I mean, they know something's up with me, but they really love Mormons and are thriving? What advice would you have in that situation for either Cheyenne or for Mormon?
For me, I found the only thing that works in my situation is to not force anything. When I talk to my son who believes, in those moments that we can talk a little more openly, and those are coming a little more frequently, I frame things in the way that I feel this about this, or first of all, I think the more forceful you are, or the more that you actually try to convince or change someone, the more that they will spend their energy resisting that change rather than consciously thinking through what you're trying to tell them. And you will end up drawing a line in the sand that they will be really careful not to let you cross. And so I think the best approach is, in my very limited opinion and limited experience, and I don't know if there is a best, but just to tell them what they're willing to hear in moments that seem open and safe, to let them know that they are safe to think and believe and interpret things in the way that they want, and that you might think and interpret and believe things in a different way, but that you love them and respect them regardless, and that the most important thing is them and is the relationship you have with them, and put the belief second. And I think that that is what is very slowly opening the door with my adopted son, who the other day, based on a comment that my daughter made about Joseph, you know, Joseph Smith, because we were making a joke about her boss said something, oh, he said, you're cute, Mom. And I said, well, Dad's out of town, maybe I can get me a boyfriend. And she said something about polygamy. And he heard that, and it went in there, apparently, because a couple weeks later, out of the blue, coming home from church, he asked me a question about Joseph Smith's wives. Like, shocker. But I did not open the fire hose on him. You have to be very careful about how you approach it. And I think just letting them know that they're safe to go through things in the way that they do lets them go through things and be more open, knowing that they're safe with you. That was a kind of a rambling answer, but that's how I roll.
So first of all, I'm reluctant to offer advice just because I don't know your situation nearly as well as you do. I also just don't want to be the guy that, you know, you follow my advice and it ends up having a horrible ending, and I'm to blame for that. So really feeling a lot of anxiety there. So skepticize everything you're about to hear from me. But one piece of advice that I heard from the Mormon Transitions podcast is a good way to just kind of sum it up in a nice little package with a bow on top is to say, my views on the church have changed. we don't have to discuss it if you don't want to. You know, and that's you know, opening the door a crack and then politely stepping back and letting them push it farther open if they want to. Another thing that I think is extremely important is to make sure that you've solidified the relationship you have with them. This is something that I did with my wife and with my daughters, is I said, honey, I want you to know I love you, I'm devoted to you. I don't know if there's going to be any afterlife or if anything's waiting for us there, but I really do want to be with you in this life. So just let them know that that's solid ground, that, you know, Dad loves you. Dad loves you, Dad's sticking with you, you know, that kind of thing. You're my kid. That kind of thing.
But I have great empathy for where you're at. Or is it empathy or sympathy? I haven't been there, but I, you know, can imagine how difficult that must be to have fear from your spouse or from your children about really being open about the way you feel. That's a rough road.
And who's to say that if there is an afterlife, that I'm not going to be able to spend the afterlife with my wife if she decides that she wants to spend that with me? How did we ever, as rational human beings, come to accept the fact that one particular Christian denomination has a corner on the afterlife and what goes on there?
Because it feels good when it's your corner, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned Kurt Vonnegut, because I considered adding that I'm really glad that since we've transitioned from Mormonism, we've been able to, as a family, increase the scope of our media consumption, like books, TV shows, movies. If I were still Mormon, we would have never watched The Matrix together. We wouldn't have watched Stranger Things or Freaks and Geeks or all of the things that we like to do.
Yeah.
Any more recommendations?
Yeah. No. PowerPoint of new media.
I'm also mindful of the clock. I know it's running out of time. There was one other just insight that I wanted to tack on. And this is touching on the whole, what do you do when you're transitioning, and the morality question, and things like that. Just for myself, I'm still living a largely LDS lifestyle, just in terms of my behavior and things. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs. Tea is delicious. Yeah. I tried coffee. I'm sorry, it doesn't work for me. I don't like football either. There's probably something wrong with me. But Earl Grey tea? I don't fool around, don't look at porn, just none of those things. And before I lost my faith, I had actually come up with rational explanations for not doing these things, right? I have kind of an obsessive personality. I've talked about scrupulosity before. So I can totally see myself, if I was to indulge in any of those vices, I would not do them in moderation. I know this about myself. So I'm voluntarily choosing to stay away from them. And in fact, you know, post-faith crisis and mid-transition, I wrote up a list, because I'm meticulous about everything I do. I wrote up a list of, okay, what are the reasons to drink and what are the reasons not to drink? And after I got done, I ultimately found that the list of reasons to not drink were lengthier and more compelling, in my mind, than the reasons to drink. And that's not a reflection on anyone else's choices. It's just my own personal, individual choice. But my primary reasons, other than the obsession one I already mentioned, I spent a lot of time living in the cloud of depression. And ever since I let go of cognitive dissonance, my depression has just gone. It's wonderful. It lightened and lightened and lightened until the dawn broke. And so I just don't think I want to cloud my mind with chemicals. I'm really just savoring living in reality. It's great. So I also think that it would make my wife unhappy if I was to embark in some kind of rumspring. You know what rumspring is, right? Yeah, it's what the Amish do, where they just go nuts and indulge in everything. Yeah, I've seen people my age that do that. We call it a midlife crisis. I'm not crazy about that idea. So
we're the session is officially over, but there is no competition for this room. And y'all can stay, and they're not going to turn the mics off, so y'all can stay and talk as long as you want. This has been a great program. Thank you very much for the opportunity for me to share it. Thanks to these absolutely fantastic panelists.